For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and today, as The Rules of Seeing is crowned debut romantic novel of 2019, its author tells us what inspired him to write about sight loss.
This new sensory information was really hindering him in many ways, as opposed to working in tandem with his other senses, which he was so used to.
Robert Kirkwood discovers how much things have changed for South African authors since the birth of the Rainbow Nation.
The apartheid regime didn't read. They will hear people saying, okay, it's written by so-and-so, and then they will ban the books. You'll find that they check who are the political activists. What kind of books do they hire from the library?
We learn more about the Omani novel that won this year's Man Booker International Prize.
Covers the period where Oman, in a sense, comes rapidly forward into the 21st century.
And listener Jill Garrett recommends a hidden gem that celebrates the natural beauty of the Lake District. That's all coming up on today's Read On.
HarperCollins presents The Rules of Seeing by Joe Heap. Read by Cariad Lloyd. Unattended luggage may be destroyed. Nova stands on the platform, waiting for the train doors to open. The February wind bleeds heat through the denim of her jeans. She dislikes Paddington. She dislikes all the big London termini. The tube she can manage and the smaller stations. But King's Cross and St Pancras, Euston and Paddington, they're all too big. Too loud and echoing, with too many people in a rush to be somewhere else. With Paddington, at least, she remembers the way to the ticket office from previous journeys, where she can ask for help in getting to the platform. Now she just hopes there won't be an alteration. Sometimes, Nova wishes she still had a guide dog. It would help with big journeys like this, with so many connections. But day to day, she can find her way with her white stick and doesn't have to clean up after a golden retriever.
Nova can do many things, but there's one thing Nova can't do. She can't see. When an operation restores her sight, Nova wakes up to a world she no longer understands, until she meets Kate. As their unlikely friendship blossoms, Kate's past threatens to throw them into a different kind of darkness. Can they both learn to see the world in a different way? That's the question posed on the dust jacket of Joe Heap's novel The Rules of Seeing, which has just been crowned debut romantic novel of 2019. When I met Joe last year, it was obvious how much he cared that the book gave an accurate portrayal of blindness and what it means to see for the first time. Joe Heap, author of The Rules of Seeing, welcome to Read On.
Hi, Red. Lovely to be here.
You're here to witness the recording of The Rules of Seeing.
I am.
How's that been going?
It's been going fantastic. It's my first book and it's the first audiobook of mine that I've seen recorded. It's very special. It's a strange feeling hearing your words read back to you, but it's especially strange hearing the characters being voiced. I think I welled up a little bit because it's almost like they're real all of a sudden, which is, it's very special.
And you've got the wonderful Cariad Lloyd narrating.
That's right. It's funny, I was listening to Cariad on the No Such Thing as a Fish podcast, I think a couple of days before my producer got in touch and said they were thinking of contacting Cariad. And I kind of felt like I was being trolled or something, like someone had bugged my phone and was listening in on me, because it's just, I find her hilarious. She's a brilliant actress. She's got a lovely voice. And it just seemed like such a perfect match to me. So I was thrilled when Cariad accepted.
Tell us a little bit more about The Rules of Seeing.
So The Rules of Seeing is about two women, Kate and Nova. Nova is 30 years old. She's been blind from birth. She is an interpreter for the Metropolitan Police. She speaks five languages. And she is offered an operation that will restore or give her sight for the first time. At hospital, she meets Kate, who is a successful architect. She's recently had a fall at home and banged her head, and she's starting to suspect that her husband, Tony, isn't the man that she thought he was. And Kate and Nova become friends, and over the course of the book, they become more than friends.
The strapline is, seeing is a matter of what you're looking for, which clearly there's a mystery aspect at the centre of the book as well.
Yes, I suppose playing on the different meanings of the word seeing. Obviously, a big part of the book is Nova's learning to see for the first time. And the title of the book, The Rules of Seeing, comes from her trying to codify for herself the very confusing world that she's been thrust into, because suddenly her brain is receiving a lot of sensory information that she has no way of processing, no way of separating out and understanding. So that's a big part of it. And it's also seeing in the sense of how we perceive other people's lives and how well we empathise with them, how much we miss in our everyday dealings with people, how much goes on beneath the surface, shall we say.
Nova has some residual sight, like 95% of us.
That's right. She can see light and dark and red in good light, but she can't see any clear detail, and she can't really use her sight to navigate in any significant way.
Which, I must say, as a blind person who has exactly that kind of residual sight, I found rather refreshing, because you used the line, you know, blindness isn't binary, and it's one of the greatest problems I think a lot of us have, is trying to explain to people why we are squinting at our mobile phone on the tube in spite of the fact that we have a white stick.
Absolutely, yeah. I think I've known several blind people or people with vision loss, and that's the thing that's always struck me, is that none of them have been in complete darkness, as it were. They've all had some degree of sight, even if that was only being able to perceive the difference between light and dark. But often it was a degree of vision that was useful to them. With Nova, I wanted to write a character for whom that residual sight was not useful in any significant way, but it was a part of her world, that it was that was the world that she had grown up with and the way that she felt comfortable.
So, what did you want to talk about? Nova asks. Not that I mind. It's good to eat somewhere other than the Scotland Yard canteen. Tell me about it. Hospital food is as bad as its reputation. Nova smiles but says nothing. She's waiting. So, I wanted to tell you about something I read in a journal. An operation. She frowns, still smiling. What kind of operation, doctor? Are you trying to get me lobotomised? He ignores the joke. An operation that could cure you. I mean, restore your sight. He knows that restore is the wrong word. You can't restore something that was never there. This is the moment that their sandwiches arrive and Nova stays silent. When she speaks again, her voice is quiet. What are you talking about? 80%, maybe more? Chance of seeing something. Chance of seeing everything. Her brother's voice, so familiar to Nova, is made exotic by excitement. That's a bold claim. Yes, she can hear him smiling, but true. She sits back, kicking her Doc Martens under her chair. The quick echoes of their words tell her that they are in a corner booth. He is trying to judge her reaction. When she speaks, she feels like an actor, her responses pre-prepared. Most people think of blindness as darkness. I know, but you can see black and white and red in good light. No, that's not what I mean.
For want of a better word, did you do your research through the people with sight loss that you know, or did you go online and look at things like the RNIB website?
I've researched it extensively, but the thing that started me off, the thing that made me want to write the book in the first place, was an account by a guy called Michael May, who wrote a piece for The Guardian, I think it was maybe 2003 or four, and he was an amazing guy. He'd been blinded in a chemical accident when he was 3 years old. He'd gone on to be a very successful entrepreneur. He set up a company that marketed pioneering GPS technology for helping blind people navigate, and I think he still has the record for fastest downhill skiing, which just seems incredible to me, just amazing. So he's an amazing guy, but at the age of 46, his doctor offered him the opportunity to potentially have some of his sight restored using retinal transplants and stem cell therapy. And he thought about it and decided to go for the treatment. And the account that he wrote was fascinating, very moving, but also I think the thing that I took away from it was that learning to see was not a straightforward positive experience. That people, you know, you're used to these inspirational kind of 30-second videos where someone's fitted with a hearing aid for the first time and it's fantastic and they can listen to music, for instance. But his experience was very much mixed. There were some fantastic things that he could see, beautiful landscapes, but at the same time he found it very confusing trying to follow what someone was saying while also watching their mouth move, and that this new sensory information was really hindering him in many ways, as opposed to working in tandem with his other senses, which he was so used to.
Absolutely. Those of us with sight loss have got used to the way we perceive the world, and it's not just an on-off switch. I think that's a nuanced argument which, you know, I'm delighted is going to be actually debated in public, because blindness isn't necessarily something that we see on the television or outdoors every day.
I think that's right, and I think that blindness is often portrayed very negatively. It's something not to be desired, and it's really a hindrance to characters in fiction. And I didn't want that to be the case in this book. I wanted a character who was perfectly happy, perfectly accomplished and capable, not despite their blindness, but because that was their world and that was what they were used to. And while I wanted to write about them gaining sight, I didn't want that to seem like a miracle experience or a wholly positive experience, but as a kind of an adventure into a new way of perceiving the world.
Now, you said that Michael's article was one inspiration. I know there was a more personal inspiration that came partway through writing the book as well.
That's right, yeah. So I was about 6 months into writing the book when my son was born, and Sam came along on a very cold February morning. I think up to that point, I hadn't really thought about the idea of creating rules for seeing, the idea of codifying this new experience in some way. The thing that I immediately noticed with Sam was that he was noticing things, that he was looking at clouds, that he was looking at water, ripples on water. And these were really direct inspirations for some of the rules in the book, because while obviously he couldn't understand a word I was saying, I wanted to be able to reach out and explain to him the presumably very bewildering things that he was seeing in front of him. I think I was struck by certain things, like how he probably couldn't understand intangible concepts. So I watched him track an aeroplane across the sky one day, and then the aeroplane disappeared into a cloud. And I think that puzzled him, because the cloud looked solid, the plane looked solid, and yet somehow one had subsumed the other. But obviously he couldn't reach out and touch the cloud and see that the cloud was not solid. So I think that just seeing him experiencing the world was a real inspiration for the book.
People think of blindness as binary, as an on or off switch. Either you can see or you're blind, right? I guess so. But it's a spectrum. Even if you can see, you can only see a tiny portion of all the light that's really there. Did you know that? I've always found that comforting, in a stupid way. It's cool. Alex says nothing. He's looking at his sister in her biker jacket and I want to believe t-shirt, wondering how she can still infuriate him this much after all these years. Her ridiculous sandwich is sitting in front of her, with a toothpick Union Jack flag claiming it for Britain, oozing sweetness onto the plate. Just think about it for a second. You feel the heat of the sun like I do, but you can't see the infrared light glowing off my skin. And you can't see radio waves, even though you know that when you turn the radio on, you'll hear the breakfast news. And it's all made of the same stuff. You just call the bit you can see light. But it's all light, fizzing around our heads. Even at night, when you can't see your hand in front of your face, there's light shining all around. She's grinning like she can see it, all the extra light.
Could you give me a couple of examples of the rules of seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. The thing about the rules of seeing is that you can start very simple, almost scientific definitions. So the first rule of seeing is that if object A occludes object B, object A is closer to you. So all that means really is that if one object appears in front of another, then it's closer, not further away. But then you get onto much more abstract or emotional rules about things like glass, which varies very much depending on the conditions. So it can be see-through, it can be reflective, it can be opaque, it's solid, even though it doesn't necessarily have any appearance. You know, people can walk into glass doors because they don't seem to be there. The idea that something solid can also be see-through is very puzzling. So the rules span lots of things. It was really just an imaginative exercise for me because obviously this is not my experience and I've really just tried to research the subject as much as possible, find as many first-person accounts as possible and then imagine myself into that position.
And I know that you're also very keen to avoid the clichés that we have about sight loss and blindness.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the thing that I've always said is that I've tried to research this as thoroughly as possible, but I do not have this experience, and the last thing on earth that I would want is for it to be cliched or for it to offend anybody or simply for it to be inaccurate. I want it to be as accurate as possible. So having the RNIB be so welcoming and so open to reading the book and providing feedback has been fantastic. One of the things in particular that they pointed out to me was that people with sight loss do not really reach out to touch people's faces to understand faces, that this is something that people do maybe with close family or children, but that really it's a Hollywood trope and it's a cliche. And I just had no idea, and I kicked myself. I was like, how did I let that one through the gate? But I had just, you know, completely believed what I'd seen in so many movies and TV series. It hadn't occurred to me that that could be wrong. And that's why it's invaluable to get the experience of people who really know what they're talking about. And yeah, I'm just very grateful for that.
Pacino in Scent of a Woman has an awful lot to answer for. And yet, actually, you know, confronted with an object in front of us, an inanimate object in front of us, the majority of us, the first thing we would do is give it a good old grope to find out exactly what it is and hope it's not hot or electric.
Yeah.
So before I allow you to get back to the audio recording, are you an audiobook fan yourself?
Oh, I'm. I cannot overstate how much of an audiobook fan I am. I was a very late reader as a child, but the thing that I loved was audiobooks, or I suppose as I would have called them then, story tapes. I'd listen to all sorts of fantastic things, and I still do. Things like Philip Pullman's Northern Lights was, I must have worn the magnetic tape out on that one, I think, from listening to it so many times. So it's very special to be here and to be listening to the audiobook being recorded, because it's something very dear to my heart.
I know that it's going to be something that users of the RNIB library are very, very much going to appreciate, that it's being released simultaneously in audiobook, talking book, and print and electronic.
That's wonderful. I'm absolutely thrilled, and I think HarperCollins are doing a great job to make the book as accessible as possible.
The Rules of Seeing is out now in paperback, and it's available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library, including as TB 703564, which is narrated by Carriad Lloyd. For more information, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
Hello, I'm Christopher Oxford, and I've been reading for RNIB Talking Books for about 6 years now. Narrating is quite an interesting thing. I've done it for some years. You gradually come to realise that it isn't just a matter of sitting and reading out of a book. There's a lot more to it than that. You've actually got to think very carefully about how to pace the narrative of a book, how to bring out the individual characterizations if it's a fiction book, how to make sure that there's a consistency of tone. You have to decide whether or not this is predominantly a comic book or a serious book, and to give it light and shade. And actually, we record for about 6 hours a day, and it is quite a feat of concentration to remain focused on reading for that period. I've had some times when I've come away from the studio feeling that I've done a full day's work. Although I've actually just been sitting in a chair in front of a microphone, I feel that I've really drawn something out of myself and really brought a kind of emotional level which perhaps one might associate more closely with being on stage. But in fact, the stage is in your mind and you're playing out a scene for it, and one hopes that the person who's listening to the book is benefiting from your performance and imagining the same world that you are.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, the independent Scottish publisher that's found international success and a shining example of nature writing. But first, it's 25 years since the Rainbow Nation of South Africa was born, and much has changed in the country, not least for its writers. Nick Mkhongo has written 3 novels and published 2 collections of short stories, most recently Soweto Under the Apricot Tree. During his first visit to Scotland, he chatted to Robert Kirkwood.
My name is Nick Mkhongo. I'm from South Africa. I'm an author.
Were there any prominent black writers in South Africa during apartheid?
There are quite a number of them, quite many actually, but they were banned by then by apartheid South Africa. I'm thinking of writers like Njabulani Ndebele, who wrote several books, including one of my favorite, which was my prescribed book in school. It's called Fools and Other Stories. There is another writer called Wale Serote, who wrote quite a number of books. One of the most important ones was To Every Blood, Every Birth There's Blood. There are just quite so many to mention. But most of them, the reason why were mostly in the world, people didn't get to know them, is because they were banned in South Africa. And then they lived in exile. They wrote about the struggles of ordinary South Africans. The books are important to us because whenever we trace the freedom of South Africa, we trace through these books. Like, for instance, there's another writer called Eske Mphahlele. He actually is one of the most known South African authors that I draw from as a writer myself. We're just talking about before apartheid, before 1994, which is the benchmark in South Africa, because it divides exactly pre-apartheid and post-apartheid. So you talk about 1994. Anything after 1994, it's us, myself, who are described as post-apartheid South African writers. So that's the difference in between. But there were lots of writers that I should think the world should know at the moment.
If the books were banned, how did you get hold of them?
Actually, it was an underground thing. So you'll find that even the idea of banning books in South Africa came because the apartheid regime didn't read. They will hear people saying, okay, it's written by so-and-so, and then they will ban the books. You'll find that they check who are the political activists? What kind of books do they hire from the library? And then even if you hire any particular book, simply because it's read by you who has been branded as a politician or a communist, the book will be banned for all the society.
Right.
So it was not, it was just an arbitrary thing. So there were, we got hold of these books because of most of our elders, for instance, would have bought the books before. And then there were lots of a movement between South Africa and other countries.
So lots of book smuggling then?
Yeah, so there were lots of book smuggling and books that were thought, and some of the books didn't even talk about politics, but simply because they were read by people who were so-called branded as, wrong people for the apartheid government.
And so after 1994, what happened to the literary scene in South Africa?
After 1994, the center of reference shifted from talking about apartheid because we had a new kind of apartheid, which was non-racial apartheid in terms of what we talk about, a new kind of apartheid. I'm talking about things like unemployment, which is a universal problem. I'm talking about things like AIDS and HIV, which is a non-racial. It can be, it can attack anybody, black, white. So I'm talking about lack of housing. I'm talking about homelessness. I'm talking about racism. And I'm talking about integration into the society, which was abnormal, you know. So those are the kind of issues that people talked about. So we had lots of things to talk about. And to write them, you didn't have to hide behind a stone, you know. You could write them in the way, because the constitution protects you. There's a freedom of expression, although you have to look in that freedom of expression in line with the limitation clause, so that you don't infringe other people's rights as well.
Right.
So it was there was lots of freedom. There was lots of things to write about. There was also happiness to write about. Oh, okay, for the first time we can vote. You know, for the first time I'm able to go to a university which is no longer only whites only university. It includes everybody. So there's that excitement, you know, and the disappointment. So so we had a lot to talk about, instead of talking about one topic, which was about how whites are bad to black people, vice versa.
And how are you finding Glasgow?
What I love is that it's mostly connected with South Africa. Connected with South Africa in a sense that I've learned a lot about the history of South Africa and the struggles that and the sacrifices of the, is it Glasgowans?
Glaswegians?
Glaswegians. The sacrifices that they made. And then towards the independence and the emancipation and the freedom of South Africa. So I understood it only when I was here. Earlier on, anybody can claim outside this city to say that we also played a role in the success and the freedom of South Africa. But today, because of Mr. David Nelson, for instance, I saw the evidence of what he was talking about since the early 70s, and the fact that people didn't have anything to lose not to support South Africa, but hence they sacrificed to support South Africa. So I learned a lot about what this city in particular did to my country, and also the fact that it's one of the first cities in the world to give Mandela his, in 1981, the freedom of the city. You know, while he was still in jail, you know? So I've seen the evidence of that. It was out of humanity. And then, and when you live, when we have lived in South Africa for as long as I've lived, you tend to think that all white people are the same. They want to be superior. And then they want to conquer, they want to subjugate black person. But I've came here and I found that it's different. White people are human, and then they've got that kindness, and it's something that I'm going to take home about the city. And because it's something that we didn't know. I don't think many South Africans know. And also I went to the Glasgow Caledonian University, sir. Mm-hmm. And I found that it had so many archives of the struggle of black people in South Africa than we have at home, you know, than we are exposed to. Mm-hmm. So that is one of the highlights of being in this place.
Thanks to Nick Mahongo. One thing we talked about, unfortunately off microphone, is something I'll just briefly mention here, as it's a lovely mix of Glasgow cheek and political commentary. St George's Place, a street in the centre of Glasgow, was home to the South African consulate. In 1986, thanks to Glasgow City Council and some high-profile supporters, that name was changed. 4 years before he was released, mail to the South African consulate in Glasgow was addressed to the new name of Nelson Mandela Place, a name which it still bears today.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and to Nick Mahongo, whose books, including Soweto Under the Apricot Tree, are available in print and ebook wherever you buy your books. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, Jill Garrett shares a hidden gem from her school days and the books of Jason Reynolds' life. But first, and staying on an international theme, this year's Man Booker International Prize has been won by Joka Alhathi for Celestial Bodies. She's the first Arabic language writer to win this prestigious award, which celebrates literature in translation from around the world. Her novel is set in Oman and focuses on three sisters, their family connections, and that country's recent history of slavery. The English translation was published by Sandstone Press, whose founder, Robert Davidson, joined me down the line from Inverness. Bob Davidson, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me, Red.
Well, many congratulations on your first International Booker Prize.
Thank you.
For those who haven't yet read Celestial Bodies, can you set the scene a little bit?
Celestial Bodies is an Omani book from an Omani author, a female author. It's a family saga. It stays, remains not only in Oman, but comes to Europe and indeed Canada. And it covers the period where Oman, in a sense, comes rapidly forward into the 21st century. Oman had slavery, Red, in living memory. The role of women has advanced rapidly. All of these things have impact on the family as they do on history. And it's a story of three sisters marrying out of duty, rejecting a lover. It's an elegant book, but has losses and loves, and it's in that area of epic family saga around the advance of Oman, which is now, I have learned, ruled by a progressive sultan, and I understand quite a stark contrast to his predecessor, and who is now much loved.
So it's very much a coming of age, not only of individuals, but of a society.
That is correct, yes.
How did you first hear about the book at Sandstone?
The book came to us from an agent, a gentleman called Charles Duckin of the Wiley Agency, and it was fielded in the usual way, as approximately 400 to 500 submissions and rising per year are fielded. We noted that it was translation. We noted the subject matter and the approach and felt that was bang in the Sandstone Press International Outlook progressive ethos. And we read it and it came to me and I read it and I felt that the themes of the book and the strong narrative qualities meant that it was one that we really did have to take, that would fit very, very well within our list, and that we could do well, which it seems we have, Red.
Absolutely. A huge success. The first book from the Gulf region, originally written in Arabic, to be awarded the International Man Booker.
That is correct.
So it had already been translated by Marilyn Booth by the time it came to you, had it?
That's right. Marilyn's role in this is a strong one. Marilyn taught, I'm not sure if she still does, but she certainly taught at the University of Edinburgh and Joker Alhapti, the author, was a PhD student there. And they met and they talked, and Joker was already an established writer, author in Oman. Madeline read the book in the original and saw the qualities that I've just described, and as she told me at the ceremony last Tuesday, is one that she felt that not only had to be translated, but had to be translated, she felt, by her. She was, through her mentor relationship with Joker, in a very empathic relationship already, and that was a very strong contributing factor to the strength of the translation.
And can you tell us a little bit more about Joker herself?
She comes from, I believe, a trading family. Very, very intelligent woman. Speaks English very well, as does her sister and her husband, whom I met. Is a Muslim woman. That's important to her, as it's important to the book.
She's an academic as well, isn't she?
Yes, she is now teaching at university in Oman, yes.
And I believe there are plans for an audio version of Celestial Bodies already in the pipeline.
Yes, from our friends at WF House, and I'm not sure whether that's going to come out, but it'll be not too distant future, I am sure.
Well, I'll look forward to listening to that and to reviewing it on the show. I mean, this is huge for Sandstone Press. I mean, I can hear the delight in your voice. What does it mean for you, apart from an excuse for a great party and reward of hard work done over the past few years?
More hard work, Red. More hard work. We have not stopped since the 9:30 p.m. or so last Tuesday night. We went to work immediately by pressing the button on the next print run, which was ready to go. We've not stopped marketing. We've not stopped publicity. We had our biggest print run ever to press the button on. And CPI, the printers in Croydon, did an amazing job because, you know, they just started on Wednesday morning and sent the books from the warehouse on Friday, which is an astonishing turnaround. Seeing how it was going, basically disintegrating on first contact with the atmosphere, you know, that those many thousands of books, we put in another order on Friday, which is due for delivery on this Friday. And I can tell you that that's ambitious as I thought it was, is also disintegrating on contact with the atmosphere, and we're discussing today what the next reprint should be. So I'm hopeful that it's very obvious we have once again become famous in the world of publishing, and books are coming in from agents all over the world for us to consider. We're moving to new offices in Inverness. We would intend to build on this success. We would intend to reach out more strongly with an even stronger list in the coming years. We would intend to strengthen those aspects, those parts of the company which we feel are perhaps less strong than the others, because when you're a growing company, as we are, as I think you know, it doesn't all grow up as a perfect sphere, like a bubble inflating. It gets stronger here, and then it gets stronger. And I would say that the wind has come at a perfect time for us, Red. We've been reconstructing the company over the past year or more, and that will continue into the future. And bang, this success, our biggest ever success, has arrived just when we're ready to handle it.
As you mentioned earlier, you're a progressive publisher who loves to bring books that might not otherwise get picked up by other publishers to the public. And so if people want to have a look at the full list of what you've got, how would they go and search?
I very much hope they'll visit our website at www.sandstonepress.com, where they'll see a line, they'll see the big Celestial Bodies panel right at the top. Four panels of news, but along the top below our logo, home, about, learn about the company there, books, our complete list of books and authors, where they will find under the letter S, S-Z-E-L-L, Red, a name that will be familiar to your family, what to do about submissions and our contact. If you're into books and authors, find all our books up to the present time.
Well, Bob Davidson, huge congratulations to all of you at Sandstone Press, and I look forward to talking to you about your next success.
Thank you very much.
Celestial Bodies by Jocker Alharthy and translated by Marilyn Booth is out now in print and ebook, with that audiobook version on its way soon.
Hello, I'm Garrick Hagen, and I've been reading for R&IB Talking Books, although I don't like to remind myself, for about 20 years. I think my first book was Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein, and I remember that that was a bit of a lesson for me, as I had to learn to sit still and be very careful about my enunciation. One of my favorite books over all those years, because we laugh so much, was Radio Romance by Garrison Keillor. It reminded me of my old radio days, although maybe they weren't as funny as Garrison Keillor's radio days. Back in Toronto, when I was a child, I had a program, and it was on Saturday mornings, but also then I did drama with young children on Saturday mornings with fairy stories. It was called Doorway to Fairyland. So it reminded me of all that, the good old times in CBC Radio in Toronto, but also because Garrison Keillor is very funny, it was a joy to read. Studio B was the Snakebite studio at WLT, the tomb of the radio mummy, and bad things happened to people who went in there. It was a big triangular room on the second floor of the Hotel Ogden, where WLT was located, at 12th and LaSalle in downtown Minneapolis. Dad Benson said it felt like a vacuum chamber. Once, he gasped for breath during Friendly Neighbor, and two huge flies dove into his throat and almost choked him. The Reverend Irving James Knox claimed he couldn't hear himself talk in there when he did Hope for Tomorrow. He was used to sanctuaries where his words rolled off the walls like ocean surf. In Studio B, the waves hit a big sponge. Reed Seymour once got the hiccups so bad in there his partial plate came off and he had to gum the news. And a week later, three of the Shepherd Boys, a gospel quartet, slipped in and quietly de-pantsed him during a long account of a tragic house fire, leaving six persons dead in St. Paul. He kept reading, but he yipped twice when they pulled off his shorts. Every other day or so, the shepherds snuck in during the noontime news to play their little tricks. They put spit in his water glass and pelted him with food, and poured mucilage in his shoes, and one day they lit the script on fire and he had to read very fast. It was an obituary, and he never got to the survived by part. So the next day Reed locked the studio door. Then, after the newscast was safely delivered, the door wouldn't unlock. That was the sort of thing that happened in Studio B. I love reading here because, first of all, it's a very friendly atmosphere, and the studios are good, and the books are generally worthy. Now I hope to continue reading for another 20 years. I hope you, as well as I, enjoy the talking books that are done here at the RNIB, and thanks for listening to them.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now, before we return to hear the books of Jason Reynolds' life, here at Read On, we love to hear about the books that you're reading and that have made a difference to you during your lives. And you can always do so by sending us an email via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk, which is exactly what my next guest, Jill Garrett, did with a book that inspired her. Jill, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. Hi, good to be here.
So Jill, please can you tell us about the book?
The Shining Levels by John Wyatt was a book that I was introduced to when I was in sixth form, which was 40 years ago. I lived near the Peak District, and our English teacher used to take us on hikes at the weekend to Lake District and all sorts of places. And this book really inspired me. It's the true story of John, who used to work in Manchester as a young lad and used to escape to the hills in the Lake District at the weekend when he could. And he loved it so much, he became a forest ranger and then eventually became first head of the Lake District National Park. And although they gave him a little stone cottage to live in, which was very basic, he decided to make a hide in the woods just with branches and live there. And his story, it's called The Shining Levels because that actually is the reflection of the lakes that he used to see as he went about his work. And it also has a more philosophical aspect to it about humanity and nature and the simplicity. Not only did he go about his job in the Lake District, and he had one other man to help him as well, and they got on very well, but he also recounts how every now and again he would go to the pub, and the fun they had in the pub, all the local people and the things they ate, the Lancashire cheese and the hot pot pies and the fruitcake. And as a youngster, as an impressionable 18-year-old, I loved nature. And the book created so many pictures in my mind as he wrote down the words describing the wood, the animals, the scenery, that I found it a very beautiful book. And it's always been my go-to book when maybe life's got a bit tough and a bit hectic. It's only a small book. It's not very long at all. It was first published in 1973. He was born in 1925. And it still creates those wonderful pictures in my mind. And I don't know if you want me to explain one of the passages that he described just about putting a fire together.
That would be lovely. Yes, please.
Once one gets the taste for smoking wood, it is possible to mix and obtain subtle flavours and invent recipes. Prepare a fire base of larch kindling. Add well-seasoned oak until the logs redden deeply. Place one large back log of holly and add from the fire back to the front one crabapple log, one well-dried cherry and one of birch. An ideal mix as an after-dinner mixture. It's full of passages like that. And he befriends two little fallow deer that come to sort of share his hide with him. These two boys brought them along one day and they ended up living with him. And so it's a very beautiful book describing nature, describing reflections of life and nature. And you really feel part of the countryside. And he went on to be the warden there until he was in his 60s, and then he retired, and then he started writing all these books. And somebody described of this book, it is an impression of a perfect wholeness that can lift you up higher. Shining levels of consciousness, and it's just by his description of some of the nature. So it's the whole philosophy and the nature, the wonderful descriptions, and I hadn't looked at it for a couple of years until I had this conversation with you, and I read it again and immediately was transported back to being that 18-year-old and reading it for the first time. So that's why I love this book. I don't know anyone else who's read it at all, but if you do a search on it, you can still buy the book. And I think it's a book that does need to be put into words to be a talking book. I really do.
I couldn't agree more. I downloaded a few pages off the internet and got my computer to read it to me. And even with that rather metallic voice, there's a beautiful simplicity to the philosophy of the book. It's very accessible and you can taste the countryside coming off the pages. It's wonderful. And I know it's been recently reprinted by Penguin, so hopefully there will be a talking book version. And, well, maybe if enough other listeners get in touch, we could ask the RNIB library if they could make it into a talking book.
Oh, that would be lovely. It's certainly includes all the senses in there. So I think it's a book that could well be shared by lots of people.
Yes, he describes the countryside and the nature around him in a very accessible way, doesn't he? You don't need to be able to see to imagine the mountains and the hills that he's describing.
No, exactly that. And his descriptions and his humour and his fun, I think he just creates this wonderful atmosphere. And somebody said, this is a book that reads like life. You never quite know where it is going to lead you next. And that's how it was for me.
It really reminded me of some of the work of Robert McFarlane, who's been writing about similar things recently. And I believe that actually John Wyatt helped recreate an interest in nature writing when it was rather out of fashion in the 70s.
Yes, I think he did, because we've gone full circle from Wordsworth and Byron, over set in the Lake District, and then the industrial north, which is where I'm from. I'm from those dark satanic hills up there. And interestingly, I have gone on to be a psychologist and a writer. I've had 3 books published, non-fiction, but to do with psychology and life, and one to do with dogs and psychology. But I just found the affinity with nature has been there all my life. And I would thank my English teacher for introducing this book, and also my lifelong interest in walking and nature and philosophy. It's a very, very significant book for me.
And I thank you, Jill, for introducing me to a book that I have to confess I'd never heard of before. But as I say, I keep my fingers crossed that it'll be a talking book soon and I can enjoy it fully.
That would be lovely. Lovely to talk to you.
And lovely to talk to you, Jill. Thank you for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Jill. And don't forget, if you've got a book that you think would expand my reading horizons, or you've found a hidden gem in the library, why not drop us a line via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Earlier this month, we interviewed the authors shortlisted for this year's Silip Carnegie Medal, celebrating the best in children's literature. Amongst them, Jason Reynolds, author of Long Way Down. Here he is with the books of his life. Jason, was there a book that you read as a young man that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
The book that made me fall in love with reading would have had to have been that Richard Wright book. I think that was the one that really cracked it open for me, Black Boy. That would have been the one that really opened things up. Just the sheer notion of there being such an exciting story from 2 pages in, you know, a kid burns his house down and things get going right away. I think that was the first.
Black Boy by Richard Wright is available commercially in print, ebook, and audio, which is narrated by Peter Francis James. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
On a rainy day, a book I'd like to curl up with and reread is a book that I do curl up with and reread often, which is Salvage the Bones by Jesmyn Ward. This very well might be my favorite book of all time. I don't know. It's something about it that I just can't get enough of. It's like trying to decode a masterpiece. I read it all the time. The language, the story, everything about it, I think, is just a work of perfection. So that would be it. Salvage the Bones by Jesmyn Ward.
Quiet. Heavy. Feels like it should be raining, but it isn't. There are no stars, and the bare bulbs of the pit burn. Get out the doorway! You're making her nervous! Skeeta is Daddy's copy. Dark, short, and lean. His body knotted with ropey muscles. He's the second child, 16. But he's the first for China. She only has eyes for him. She ain't studying us, Randall says. He's the oldest, 17. Taller than Daddy, but just as dark. He has narrow shoulders and eyes that look like they want to jump out of his head. People at school think he's a nerd, but when he's on the basketball court, he moves like a rabbit, all quick grace and long haunches. When Daddy is hunting, I always cheer for the rabbit. She need room to breathe. Skeeta's hands slide over her fur, and he leans in to listen to her belly. She gotta relax. Ain't nothing about her relaxed. Randall is standing at the side of the open doorway, holding the sheet that Skeeter had nailed up for a door. For the past week, Skeeter has been sleeping in the shed, waiting for the birth. Every night I waited until he cut the light off, until I knew he was asleep, and I walked out of the back door to the shed, stood where I'm standing now to check on him. Every time, I found him asleep, his chest tore back. He curled around China like a fingernail around flesh. I want to see. Junior is hugging Randall's leg, leaning in to see, but without the courage to stick in more than his nose. China usually ignores the rest of us, and Junior usually ignores her. But he's 7, and he's curious.
Salvage the Bones by Jesmyn Ward is out now wherever you buy your books, in paperback, ebook, and audio, which is narrated by Cherise Booth. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Recently, I just finished reading Red at the Bone by Jacqueline Woodson. It is not out yet. It comes out in a little bit, a couple of months. But Red at the Bone by Jacqueline Woodson is an intergenerational tale about motherhood, about teenage motherhood, about sort of just down. It's just a brilliant, really simple and yet really complex tale about love and friendship and family and resentment and how motherhood doesn't always come natural. And it's just really stunning. And so that would be the one that I've just read that I hope everybody checks it out.
As Jason said, Red at the Bone by Jacqueline Woodson will be published later this year. Jason Reynolds, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so much.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.